Eleanor Clift, is a contributing editor for Newsweek. She is also a political analyst for the Fox News Network and often appears as a panelist on the McLaughlin Group. Clift has co-authored two books with Tom Brazaitis, including War Without Bloodshed, The Art of Politics, and Madam President, Shattering the Last Great Ceiling. Her most recent book, Founding Sisters and the 19th Amendment, brings us to the subject of her talk today, Votes for Women, Lessons from a Long Struggle. Please extend a warm welcome to Eleanor Clift.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm very glad to be here. Of course, I'm glad to be anywhere where I get to finish a sentence without getting interrupted. So I think some of you may recognize me from my other life on TV, but basically I'm a print journalist and with a love of the written word. And when I got a call from a book publisher out of the blue asking if I wanted to write a book on the 19th Amendment, my initial thought was, what is the 19th Amendment? I knew there was an amendment around that time. It was the 18th Amendment, actually, Prohibition, and I kind of thought maybe that's what they wanted me to write a book about. My knowledge of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote, was very scant. And I'm embarrassed to say that how little I knew, and here I was a journalist specializing in issues concerning contemporary women and politics. And so I readily agreed to do this, thinking I would plug in an education that was woefully inadequate, and in that I am not alone. Most of the history books treat suffrage as a sidebar. There's a very stern-looking woman staring out at you, and the language basically says they marched for 30 years and they were given the vote, and let's move on. There is really no sense of the 72-year struggle that this was, beginning in 1848 and culminating in 1920 when the Congress passed the amendment and it was ratified by two-thirds of the states. And during much of that time, the majority of women in this country did not particularly care about getting the vote, and many were openly hostile towards suffrage. The word suffrage itself is off-putting. It comes from the Latin suffragium, to vote, and it has been really, I think, treated quite scantily, and I am not alone. I mean, it is not just my education that was lacking. I think it is fairly universal, and partly it's because once the amendment was passed, the women didn't go about building monuments to themselves. They didn't hold centennials and sesquicentennials, and we're a little late getting around to that. And yet they engineered the greatest expansion of democracy in a single day that the world had ever seen. And their story has all the twists and turns of a modern thriller. There was racial conflict, and that really did capture my interest. The movement divided over whether to support the extension of the vote to Negroes after the Civil War and to deny the vote to women. And the suffrage advocates at that time thought they had a deal with President Lincoln, that if they suspended their suffrage activities during the war, that he would extend the vote to women after the war was over. Now, the deal collapsed when President Lincoln was assassinated, and his successor, Andrew Johnson, a Democrat and a Southern planter, was not sympathetic to women. The early suffragists were abolitionists, but their frustration over being denied the vote led them to accommodate racist views to win the support of Southern state legislators. And that's the kind of, I think, persistent theme in our politics of the trade-off in order to win the votes of conservative sympathizers. And in the South, of course, the theme of the Southern strategy is a thread that, you know, we have seen in our two-party system. I focus on two sets of founding sisters, and Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton really started it all with a women's convention in Seneca Falls, New York in 1848. Actually, Anthony didn't attend that because she was busy as a prohibition activist. And she only became a member of the suffrage cause when she did all the organization for an abolitionist meeting and the men wouldn't allow her to speak. And so she took the advice of Frederick Douglass, her friend, who said that the vote is the ticket of admission to a democratic society, and that had to be the first order of business. But that Seneca Falls Convention was started really by a group of women around a kitchen table, and they put a little ad in the local paper, and they were amazed when on a July weekday morning in 1848, 300 people showed up. The women were so unaccustomed to public speaking or legislative language, parliamentary language, that they actually let the men run the meeting. But that was the last time that happened. They learned pretty quickly. And the partnership between Anthony and Stanton was truly remarkable. They were such different people. Susan B. Anthony was a school teacher. She never married. She was very disciplined. Her work was everything. She was all angles and severity in her physical appearance. Whereas Stanton was round, jolly. Actually, she got a little too round and jolly. She was over 300 pounds when she eventually died. But she had 7 children, and she was this really creative, free spirit. And so the two of them were very different, and Anthony would get so frustrated at Stanton because she kept having these babies, and it would interfere with the suffrage activities. And Anthony, in one of her memoirs, recalls walking past the Stanton household and seeing the boys on the roof debating over whether the baby would bounce if they rolled him off. I think of them as sort of poetry and prose because they were so different, yet they were complementary. And yet they both died before their vision could be realized. And so their less well-known successors, Alice Paul and Carrie Chapman Catt, are the ones who pushed the amendment through to passage on Capitol Hill and then to ratification. And unlike Anthony and Stanton, Alice Paul and Carrie Chapman Catt didn't get along. They didn't much like each other at all. They were a generation apart, and they had completely different ideas as to how the suffrage movement should proceed. Every movement seems to divide into radicals versus moderates, and so I think of Alice Paul as the head radical and Catt as the head moderate. Catt was the tactician. Eleanor Roosevelt called her the most organized woman that she'd ever met. She didn't like confrontation. She thought that women could get the vote if they simply out-organized the opposition state by state. And actually, she was on her way to proving that, I mean, because I think 10 or 11 states actually did have allow women to vote by the time the amendment finally passed. Catt had some ahead of the time events in her personal life. Her first husband died soon after they were married and left her with a tidy little fortune. And when she remarried, she negotiated a prenup with her husband that allowed her 4 months of every year for her suffrage activities. She was the first in her class at Iowa State, and she became a school superintendent in 3 years, which was a dramatic rise for a woman of that time. Iowa was still the frontier, and the frontier states had to be a little nicer to women to get them to stay. But Catt was basically a sensible frontier woman who believed a lot in practical solutions, and she went on to found the League of Women Voters. It seems like a very natural progression. Now, Alice Paul was a generation younger. She was a Quaker. And in her early development, there was nothing really that would suggest she would go on to become this radical. She used thee and thou, and she was very deferential to her family and everybody else. But she was a graduate of Swarthmore, and she had advanced degree from the University of Pennsylvania. This actually stunned me. I didn't know women did that in that time. And in 1907, young Alice went abroad to continue her studies, much like women today. And she went to London, and there she became fascinated by the British feminist movement. And she joined the Pankhurst sisters. She was arrested and she became radicalized. And when she came back to the States in 1911, she was amazed that the American suffrage movement was so lackluster. It was stalled. It was sedate. The American suffrages were feted at dinners and they were celebrated. They just were making no progress to getting the vote. And young Alice determined that the party in power had to be confronted. And the Democrats controlled both houses of Congress, and Woodrow Wilson was on his way to winning the presidency. And she organized the first protest of a presidential inauguration. And when Wilson arrived in Washington in 1913 at Union Station, he looked around and said, "Where are all the crowds?" And he was told, "They're over on the avenue looking at the ladies." And Alice Paul had organized a parade of 800 women, women in their factory uniforms, women in their academic gowns, women in their nurses' uniforms. And at the head of the parade was a woman described as the most beautiful suffragist ever, and she was on a white horse with wings. She was the warrior princess. And it was a grand spectacle, but lining the parade route were men who didn't like the evolving social order, and they were jeering the women, throwing lighted cigarette butts, throwing tomatoes. And the headlines the next day were 100 women taken to area hospitals. Among the women who were disoriented was Helen Keller, who was there to speak at Constitutional Hall. I don't know quite how she spoke, but this is what the clip that I found in a Chicago paper, and it said she was disoriented by all the commotion going on around her. Carrie Chapman Catt was horrified at the headlines and at the turn of events. She thought the hooligan tactics of the British had come to America's shores. But young Alice realized, while she didn't condone the violence, that she had, for the first time, the sympathy of a nation and that she needed to build on that. So I think Alice Paul is really the appropriate historical figure to focus on, because she had what is needed today. She had a sense of public relations and marketing. And she knew that she had to work to keep the attention of the nation, and she did that through various tactics to confront the government. When Woodrow Wilson would see the silent sentinel standing outside the White House gates, at first he was amused. He would tip his hat. Then he thought once the weather got cold or hot, they would go. When it got cold, they would carry heated bricks over for the women to stand on. And when it got too hot, they would simply take turns. These were upper-class women who, if they weren't protesting, would be having high tea somewhere. And there was like a revolving door. And Wilson was getting involved in a war, and he thought, "I'm a war president. I shouldn't have to deal with this." And so he ordered arrests. And the women were arrests for rather spurious violations, interrupting traffic and so forth. And they were held for short periods of time, but they just kept coming back. And so finally the crackdown did get more severe, and the women were held for longer periods of time. And they went on a hunger strike, and the government ordered force feedings. And it's a particularly brutal procedure where an iron pipe is shoved down your throat and raw eggs poured down your gullet. And it is the title of the HBO movie, Iron Jawed Angels, derives from the process of the force feeding. And Hilary Swank plays Alice Paul, and I would commend to all of your teachers a way to reach particularly young women today is to have an Academy Award actress playing a suffragist. They'll actually think maybe that Hilary Swank was the one who did the protesting, but that's okay because it makes history accessible. And while the women were being jailed and being subjected to some pretty horrific treatment, they would smuggle out their notes, just like Martin Luther King would later from the Birmingham jail. And Alice Paul would circulate these notes. She would blanket the country with press releases. And she stayed off the picket lines because she initially felt she was too valuable in spreading the message. But she eventually gets arrested herself. And they are so concerned, they being the government officials, are so concerned about her fanatical influence over this movement, that they commit her to St. Elizabeth's Hospital, which is in the Washington Arena, and is known for psychiatric facilities. They tried to commit her for having an unhealthy obsession with Woodrow Wilson. When I read this, I couldn't believe it happened, and I thought, you know, why didn't I know this? Well, they couldn't hold her for very long because the government lawyers realized that was beyond the pale. And after a time, after a very long time, almost the full 8 years of Wilson's presidency, and he had the husbands of women who were jailed coming, big donors finally coming to tell him this cannot continue. He was finally shamed enough that he presented women's suffrage to the Democratic Congress as a war measure, because the Congress had said they would only deal with issues having to do with the war. And you would think that would be the end of it, but there was still plenty of drama left. The Democratic Congress rebuffs President Wilson, an extraordinary rejection of a president in wartime. And then the midterm elections get held, and the Republicans take over. And then the Democrats realize, whoops, suffrage must be popular out there, because it had by now become popular. And the Democrats convene in a lame duck session to hastily pass suffrage so they could get credit. The Republicans block it. They're not going to give it to the Democrats at this point. So it's not until the new Republican Congress comes into power that suffrage finally gets passed. But it has to be then ratified by then 34 states. And all that struggle, all those years, come down to the state of Tennessee, a divided vote, and suffrage is about to be tabled, and they'll have to go back to square one, when the youngest legislator in the Tennessee House stands up and says he's going to change his vote from a no to a yes, explaining that he had gotten a telegram from his mother that morning urging him to be a good boy and support ratification. Young Harry Birney was 24 years old. He actually needed a bodyguard when he went back home to his rural district in Mouse Creek, Tennessee. But he had been sympathetic to suffrage, but he was torn. Should he represent his constituents, which didn't want it, or should he do what he thought was right? And he finally did what he thought was right, but they investigated him thinking he'd taken money from liquor interests or something. When you look back and you think that all of this brouhaha over something that seems so obvious, that women should have the vote, that black men and women are equal to white men and women, you see all the struggle that we go through as a society, but you also see how reform is made in this country. It is made slowly, with difficult, painful compromises, and it's driven by a handful of powerful personalities and by the acts, the everyday acts, of a lot of unsung people. Martin Luther King actually cited Alice Paul as someone who inspired him in his nonviolent resistance. And what to me is sad, that almost as soon as women got the vote, they took it for granted. And voting participation rates dropped precipitously. And it was a reality that Carrie Chapman Catt, who died in 1947 at age 86, found despairing. And she said, "Women have suffered an agony of soul which you can never comprehend, so that your daughters might inherit political freedom. That vote has been costly. Prize it." We live today in an age of intensely partisan politics, and I think, you know, the country is really looking for leaders who can find the issues that cross party lines and cement loyalty, which is really what the Founding Sisters did 100 years ago. Thank you.